The following program is being brought to you on the Voice America Business Channel. For more information about our network and to check our additional show hosts and topics of interest, please visit voiceamericabusiness.com. The Voice America Talk Radio Network is the worldwide leader in live Internet talk radio. Visit voiceamerica.com. The views and ideas expressed on the following program are strictly those of the host or guests and do not necessarily reflect the views and ideas held by the Voice America Talk Radio Network, its staff, and management.
Have the changes in the banking industry affected you? With the looming possibility that your local bank branch might disappear and more web, mobile, and social technologies, what will the changes mean for you and your business? Welcome to Breaking Banks with your host, Brett King. The possibility that banking is no longer a place you go, but just something that you do, has become very real. Now, here is Brett King.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Breaking Banks. Welcome back to Breaking Banks for those of you who are regular listeners. I'm calling from New York today. As you guys know, I'm based in New York, and I will say it's an absolutely wonderful, stunning day sitting here in New York. The sun is shining, and it's one of those days you love being in New York, walking around town. So I just thought I'd share that. It's not the theme of our discussion today, but it's great to be in New York today. So one of the challenges we're finding in the financial economy is that conventional wisdom would have it that as an economy becomes more advanced and as the economy starts to make progress and as an economy becomes more developed, if you take say something like an economy like China or India or Brazil, that as this economy develops, as more money comes into the system, as people get more affluent, then it is fairly predictable that more people will come into the banking system. People that haven't been affluent before, suddenly now get into the middle class. They need a bank account, they need a mortgage, they need a home loan, and so they become one of the banked population. Now, the World Bank estimates that between 60 and 65% of the world's population today doesn't have a bank account. So if you have a bank account today, then you're actually in the minority from a global sense. But things have started to change there. We've got economies like Kenya, M-Pesa, where mobile phones are enabling a basic sort of bank account. And you've got these economies as they advance, where more and more people are now getting access to the banking system. Now, conventional wisdom would have it that in a market like the United States, that we should now be pretty much with 100% of the population that has a bank account. Because, the United States is one of the most advanced economies in the world. The problem is that we seem to have sort of leveled out to a point where, according to the FDIC, 25% of U.S. households are either unbanked or underbanked. Now, to make the distinction between those two classifications, someone who's unbanked has no typical financial instrument or financial product at all. Someone who's underbanked may have a basic type of debit card, but doesn't have access typically to credit facilities and things like that. So, you have a quarter of American households who fall into this category. The interesting thing, though, is rather than shrinking, this group has actually grown a little bit in the last few years. So it appears people are opting out of the traditional banking system. Maybe this is due to prepaid cards. Maybe it's due to other services that now enable people to do pseudo banking without having a traditional checking account. So this is the theme of the show today. What's happening in the unbanked and underbanked space? What's needed? And, where is this space going? Does everybody in the world need a bank account? Or is there going to be alternative solutions to that? So we're very grateful to have with us on the show today some really key people in this movement. Rachel Schneider is with us first up. Rachel is actually with the CFSI, the Center for Financial Services Innovation. Is that correct, Rachel?
Yep, you managed to get that mouthful out. Which is always good.
So tell me about your role with CFSI and tell me about what CFSI does for those that aren't familiar with your work.
Terrific. I'm happy to do that, and I'm really happy to join you in this conversation today. I'm looking forward to it. So the Center for Financial Services Innovation is a nonprofit. We've been around for almost a decade. And we were founded really out of realization of exactly the issues that you were just sharing, that there are millions and millions of Americans who choose not to use traditional banking products or use them but also rely on other services. And we wanted to better understand that issue and understand the role that financial services play in people's lives and advance the mechanisms through which financial services could be helpful for people. So our core belief as an organization is that financial services have a role in people's financial lives that's somehow different than other consumer products, that financial services are relevant to achieving greater financial stability or greater mobility, or we talk about it as just greater financial health, and that financial services are somehow important. And so what we do is we research consumer needs. We work directly with financial services companies to ideate and develop and deliver better financial services that would help people to achieve greater financial health. And so, you know, we think there's been a ton of interesting, intriguing change over the last 10 years, and we feel incredible momentum around this issue and opportunity to better meet the needs of consumers. So we look forward to the next 10 years, I guess.
Yeah. So you know, there's been a host of neobanks, you know, sort of strike up recently. You know, we're obviously familiar with the Walmart GoBank play. You know, we have Bluebird from Amex. We have a number of these, you know, Moovin, who, as in full disclosure, I'm involved in. So, you know, what role is prepaid cards sort of playing in sort of enabling basic banking for this segment of Americans?
Huge. I think it's a game changer in a lot of ways. So you, just in even the language we use to talk about this issue, the idea of underbanked, you can hear a predisposition toward what the solution is for people, right? So
right.
When...
Yes.
Organizations like CFSI and others started thinking about underbanked issues 10 years ago, it was, in many ways, with an assumption that we need to figure out how to enable more banking. And that's, you know, in some ways, they're just...
It's logical why we would jump to that conclusion. Right?
Exactly. I mean, now, 10 years later, as you see how much technology has changed how people manage their money, that's, you know, much less obvious. But at the time, what was happening was the government really realized that there were millions of people who were underbanked when they tried to move towards electronic disbursements of all benefits and figured out that a lot of people had no way to receive this electronic transfer. And so the assumption was, oh, well, these are people who need bank accounts. I think 10 years later, you look around and you think, well, Walmart's providing these services really cost-effectively. And people are using mobile phones for everything else and the internet for everything else. So traditional brick-and-mortar, retail-delivered banking isn't necessarily the answer. What we're aiming for is high-quality financial services access for everyone. And in a lot of cases, that's coming on a prepaid card backbone.
Right. Now, you know, one of the other aspects of your work, I know, is trying to improve financial literacy, financial education of people who haven't traditionally been in the financial services sector as consumers. So tell me a bit about, you know, the efforts that are going on, you know, particularly in the United States to improve financial literacy and you know, what your role is in that broadly.
Sure. I take a deep breath before I get into that question because I think the use of financial information and knowledge and the ability to make good decisions is obviously important for all consumers. And yet financial literacy itself isn't really a behavior changer. So when people have more information, they don't necessarily then behave differently. Like the best example I always think of there is about nutrition, right? I know I should be eating healthily. It doesn't mean I'm not going to have a cookie. And so when we think about financial education-related efforts at CFSI, what we want to encourage is the marriage of advice, information, with the tools that enable people to make then better choices for themselves. So show, we talk about it as financial capability. And in fact, there's been a sea change in the country in a lot of ways as more and more people talk about financial capability as the ultimate goal. So how do we deliver advice through the structure of a product or in partnership with the structure of a product? And again, the fact that we've transitioned from bricks and mortar delivery of all services to mobile and other creative ways to reach people provides so much opportunity there. So you think about the utility of balance alerts to help people manage what their balance is today and maintain a focus on longer-term goals over near-term spending goals. Or, you know, I know it's concepts that you've thought a lot about, Brett. And I think what we'd like to see at CFSI is more and more that people think in that framework rather than thinking about financial literacy in a traditional sense of I'm going to teach you this curriculum and then you're going to know what to do next.
Right. So, you know, we've seen some increased efforts to regulate this space, particularly sort of the prepaid space recently. And, you know, the government's recent efforts to, you know, the new swipe fee regulations and things like that. You know, is it possible that through trying to tighten up access and regulations around this space that this product, which seems to have, you know, as there's been, I just saw a report from Visa yesterday, actually, where compound annual growth rate for prepaid cards in the United States over the last 6 years has been 16% year on year. And in fact, the last 2 years was 25% year on year growth. So we've got massive growth, whereas during the financial crisis, checking accounts actually shrunk by 4% in the United States. So obviously, this new space, prepaid, has got a lot of attention. The regulators are giving it some attention. Is there a fear that actually this product that's now being used, as you say, is this backbone of this day-to-day participation in the banking system by a large segment of people in the U.S. might be sort of squeezed out because there's a bias towards a traditional checking account approach and going into a bank branch and, you know, signing that piece of paper and getting a real bank account instead of a prepaid card? Do you think that that's a risk?
Well, I think that, so there's a lot bundled into that question. I mean, I think that, to unpack it a little bit, I think prepaid inherently has benefits for underserved consumers. So relative to checking, relative to check cashing, it's a product that has a real purpose and benefit for people, right? So the ability to make electronic transactions, the ability to keep and store funds safely, securely, the ability to spend exactly what you have, right? So the fact that prepaid currently generally doesn't offer the ability to overdraft is for many people a huge benefit relative to a checking account. So there's a lot of reasons to be optimistic about prepaid and that probably are behind why you're seeing that year-over-year growth. So this has become a huge, valuable product category for customers who were either previously banked and unhappy about it or living primarily in cash or left out of the ability to make electronic transactions. Right, so there's a ton here to try and protect and make sure stays strong in the prepaid industry. At the I was going to say at the same time, financial services are a regulated industry in the U.S., and so if prepaid wants to, as an industry, survive, it's going to need to manage living in a regulated environment. And that means providing customers with the same or comparable levels of consumer protection as you would get by interacting with a bank, a regulated institution. So because banks are part of the supply chain in the delivery of prepaid, there's every reason to think that a prepaid card can be as safe of a product for customers as a checking account. And it is important that the industry make sure that be the case.
Yeah. So, you know, we're coming up to a break, but I want to continue this discussion after the break. The fee structure, it's probably, you know, for people who are used to free checking in the U.S., which has always been a big selling point for many banks trying to get you to switch, most of these prepaid cards actually charge a fee, but there seems to be a fairly high acceptance of that. Can you sort of work out why that is, why people are happy to pay a fee for these products?
Absolutely. And why? Right. So the fee is coming in a very transparent, clear way. So it's either I pay a fee on a monthly basis or I pay a fee every time I use the card. Either way, you know what you're getting into, which is a huge value for underserved consumers who would much rather pay a fee now than think, you know, be told I'm going to get a free service and then on the back end get charged something they didn't expect.
Yeah.
And so free checking usually wasn't entirely free, particularly if you don't have a minimum balance to hold into the account. And so a lot of underserved folks are people who had checking accounts that were either supposed to be free or low cost, but they ended up paying lots of overdraft charges, or they got nickeled and dimed and other kind of small stuff they didn't expect. And so I think you have to think about fees in that context. Is it transparent? Do people know what they're getting in advance? Not, is there a fee in it and is that bad, right? Businesses need to charge fees in order to make the services sustainable. And I think people understand that.
So let's have a quick break. After the break, I'd like to continue this discussion. We also got another guest we're going to invite on during the next segment as well. So you can stick around, Rachel.
Terrific.
Great. So we'll be back just after this break.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
Is your business model robust enough? In today's ever-changing business environment, people are working to transform themselves, their futures, and their business. Tune in to Business Reinvention with your host, Nancy Lynn. To stay ahead of the game in business, you have to constantly reinvent yourself and your organization. With Nancy's experience and that of her guest experts, you'll learn from stories of inspiration, innovation, and forward thinking. Listen for Business Reinvention live every Monday at 4 p.m. Pacific Time, 7 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel.
Dialogue is the single most powerful leadership tool we have to make a difference in the world. Leading Conversations with host Cheryl Esposito creates a place for that dialogue. Tune into the Voice America Business Channel every Friday as Cheryl hosts new conversations among leaders from around the world in business, government, art, economics, and social change. We'll explore big ideas and everyday actions and learn how their own leadership has led them to discover a newfound sense of possibility in the world. Leading Conversations with Cheryl Esposito, bringing big thinkers together in conversations that make a difference, right here on the Voice America Business Channel every Friday morning at 10 a.m. Pacific Standard Time.
We're always talking business. Talk to an expert. Call now toll free 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
You are listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or send an email to breakingbanksradio@gmail.com. Now, back to the program.
You're back with Breaking Banks. I'm your host, Brett King. We're on right now with Rachel Schneider. Rachel is with the Center for Financial Services Innovation. Rachel, sorry, what was your title at the CFSI?
Well, I'm the Senior Vice President of Insights and Analytics.
And where are you based, Rachel?
So I'm based in New York, like you, but today I'm sitting here in what should be sunny California is actually drastically overcast California.
Okay, well, normally it's the other way around, right?
Yeah, exactly.
So we were talking before the break about the attractiveness of prepaid cards for the underbanked and unbanked segment. This is traditionally a group of people that have been very cash-based. There's been a tendency to get the paycheck at the end of the month, get that cashed, pay their bills, and then they've got their remaining cash budget. But of course, today it's pretty difficult to exist in the financial system without access to a debit card. If you want to buy a plane ticket or you want to buy stuff online, a plastic card goes a long way to helping people. So why do you think it is that people, we got into the fee structure a bit and we got into the overdraft thing. In the research that you guys do, because I know you do a ton of research, are there other factors involved in why prepaid has become so popular within that segment? And I know it's not just the underbanked and unbanked who use prepaid, but let's focus on them first. You know, what are the key highlights there in terms of why that product has been so successful and popular?
Well, there are many, and you indicated some of them. I think the best way to think about it is in the effort for control. So particularly underserved consumers, or think of this as somebody who's living break-even over the course of the year, right? They're able to meet expenses with their income for the most part, but any given day they might be behind. And this is somebody who's potentially living, right, at the edge of their means. And so being able to keep a minimum balance in a checking account is not really realistic. This is somebody who needs to know today, how much money do I have? I'm standing in the checkout line. When I swipe my card, is it going to go through and I'm going to be able to pay for this whole set of groceries I've picked? Or am I going to have to go put something back because I don't have exactly as much money as I'm trying to spend right now? And so prepaid cards are a terrific mechanism to maintain financial control and know exactly what you have, spend exactly what you have, manage your finances closely. And I think that's a key reason why they've become a trusted product category for other people as well. You saw post-recession more people using prepaid cards as a way to manage their spending. So I'll put $300 on my card for this week or this month or whatever my budget allows, and that's what I can spend on entertainment. Or, you know, this is the amount of money I can give to a relative or a employee or a friend for some reason, right? And so I think prepaid cards are naturally predisposed towards helping people to maintain control over their finances, and that's a core need for lots of people in today's economic environment.
So, you know, what percentage of people fall into this bracket of, in the U.S., living paycheck to paycheck? But, you know, that's what you described, sort of living on that break-even edge in terms of their financial health.
You know, that's a big question. I think there were some numbers recently talking about as many as 2/3 of Americans who would describe themselves as living paycheck to paycheck. FINRA does a regular study about the number of people who have enough funds saved to make it through 2 months if they didn't, you know, if they were to lose their job and not have income coming in, and the numbers are painfully low, right? You know, sort of half of Americans could survive if they didn't get their income today. You know, could pay their bills for the next few months with no hardship. So as a country, right, we don't have huge stores of savings for the most part, tucked away. And so it's a big group. It's not just underserved who think about their money as from month to month or week to week.
So, you know, one of the things, though, is that, you know, the prepaid product, you know, I know there's some crossover here. We have some of the Gen Ys who have, you know, taken prepaid as sort of their first bank account and gaining experience with the system in that way. But there is a large percentage also in this underbanked and unbanked space. But, you know, it doesn't have do people really save on this platform, or is it more just this day-to-day discretionary spending that tends to be the primary use case of these cards?
So, there are a number of prepaid cards that offer the ability to save, to have a savings account on the side. Usually it's just some kind of a savings bucket, and you can transfer funds from the prepaid card to the savings feature. And, for example, Netspend has long had a savings feature. A card called Banking Up has a savings feature called the Rainy Day Reserve, and they've done some research recently with the D2D Fund about its usage. And what you see is people accumulating a few $100s. So don't think of this as savings for my down payment, but savings for that rainy day, savings for my car breaks down, savings for my, I needed to make some repair in my house, that kind of savings. Yep. But there's a huge benefit to that savings, because if you think about this person I've described who's living week to week or month to month, to be able to just get ahead, to know I've got $200 stocked away is
a huge
mental difference versus, can I pay my bills today? And so there's massive benefits there. The other issue that your question pointed to, I think is really interesting, which is that millennials tend to gravitate towards these kind of products. And I think part of what's going on there is that the innovations that we've seen in the financial services industry, trying to solve the sort of tough needs of underserved folks, tend to have broader applicability.
Right.
Right? Because you're working harder to innovate as a company to meet this need, it turns out that there's some broader application of that idea, what you thought of. And millennials being interested in some of these same features, control, immediate information, I think is a nice example of that.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. So, listen, let's invite Danny to join this conversation right now. So, we have Danny Shader who's joining us. Danny, I can't remember where you're based. I think it's on the West Coast as well.
We're in Silicon Valley in Sunnyvale, California.
Great. So you're the founder and CEO of a company called PayNearMe, and you're really sort of involved in this sort of retooling aspect, in this space where people are using a lot of cash in the economy, using their mobile, enabling businesses who are working with this sort of segment. Tell us a bit more about what PayNearMe does and, where you fit in this solution.
Sure. What we do is we turn cash into an electronic form of tender, so that it looks to remote systems like it's a first-class peer of ACH, checking payment, electronic checking payments, or credit card payments. So as we see it, there's somewhere between 60 and 100 million Americans who need or prefer to pay with cash. There's the un- and the underbanked segment we've been talking about, which, Rachel will have better data than me, but I believe it's on the order of 60 million folks. There's two other segments that care a lot about cash, and this sort of goes to the point that Rachel was just making about some of the overlap. One is teens. So, for example, we pay our babysitter with cash. She's got cash and she's locked out of, she can only physically hand that to other people. And then there's all the folks who have access to traditional banking products, but for whatever reason, typically a privacy reason or a budgeting reason, they just don't want to use plastic. And by the way, one interesting case where that comes up is people not wanting their spouses to know what they're purchasing. And before you jump to the conclusion that that's something, inappropriate, it actually tends to be more of things like shoes and fishing rods and purses and such, where, basically discretionary purchases where people want to keep their decisions to themselves. Yeah. So all of these folks, if you think about it, they all rely on cash to some extent or other. If you think about that at the same time about some very major macro trends that are going on, one is that every form of transaction you can imagine is going remote. So we know clearly that commerce is going remote, where I think we're all kind of thinking commercey here, which is e-commerce or m-commerce. But, bill payment is going remote. Electronic bill presentment and payment is a huge and growing business. That's a form of remote transaction.
Yep.
And banking obviously is going remote with things like remote deposit capture. So if you're a person who needs to prefer to pay with cash, you are for the most part locked out of most forms of remote transactions. Now, what's interesting is we've all talked about how expensive it is to operate a branch of a bank. It turns out that the most cost-efficient cash handling networks in the country are operated by the retailers because retailers prefer cash, right? It's their lowest cost form of tender. Typically the marginal cost of processing cash for retailers on the order of 20 basis points. So, and by the way, another phenomenon that's really interesting that I think that Rachel alluded to is if you look at the penetration of smartphones, as high as it is for the population as a whole, it's even higher for the underserved, both because the immigrant population tends to skew younger and because these are folks who, for the most part, are just skipping computers and traditional internet connectivity entirely. So if you put all that together, the insight that we've had is that you can build a network that leverages the cash handling capability of retailers and the use of mobile phones, smartphones, to let consumers conduct a wide range of remote transactions using cash. And essentially what we do in our system is we turn cash at the POS of a local store into an electronic signal that is in real time connected to, for example, a property management system for paying rent, a bus ticketing system as we're doing at Greyhound, a loan management system. Very importantly, as I'm sure we'll talk about, insurance payments under the Affordable Care Act, and even banking, bank deposits and other systems. So basically,
I walk into a 7-Eleven. I've got, I got my paycheck, or I've got a wad of cash, I've got $500, I've got these bills to pay, and you can essentially then, you know, I can walk into a 7-Eleven, exchange this cash, and do these electronic payments through the network or the system.
I think that's right, but I would want to make a key distinction, which is there have been for many years walk-up payment networks operated by, you know, the traditional remittance companies that have a model where you can walk up to a window, provide cash, and have funds.
Or check cashing businesses.
Yeah, check cashers tend to be locations where this happens. Those models are inherently expensive and time-consuming because they're consumer-initiated transactions. What we've done is use the traditional payment processing of doing a – we're really a merchant processor. So the business that wants to get paid sets up a pending transaction in our system, and that transaction is completed when the consumer presents cash and a barcode like the screen of their phone or printed on a bill at the register. And at the moment they do that, in real time, the POS reaches out to us. We reach out to that business. The business authorizes acceptance of funds and treats the transaction as paid, all in real time.
Right.
So it's not a traditional walk-up bill payment model like you've described.
It's a pull, model instead of a push model.
It's exactly the way to describe it.
Yeah.
As a result, by the way, just to be clear, these transactions process in 30 seconds, you know, instead of 5 minutes, and they happen in the checkout lane, and they can happen 24/7, and you know, they typically are either free to the consumer or a fraction of what an expedited payment would be through the money transmitters.
Absolutely. So we're just coming up to a break, but Danny and Rachel, what I'd like to do is I'd like to talk about the mobile factor here,
how
mobile's changing this, and then we can talk about the Affordable Care Act as well, Danny, if you like. So we're coming to a quick break. If you'd like to call in, if you've got some questions, please dial in. Our dial-in number is 866-472-5790. Please feel free to jump in, or you can get us on Twitter. Use the hashtag Breaking Banks, and you're with Breaking Banks and Brett King. We'll be back right after the break.
We're always talking business. Talk to an expert. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
Our workplace is dynamically changing. How do you stay ahead of the curve with respect to learning and training? Tune in every week to The Future of Workforce Learning and Development with host Pamela Robinson. You'll learn about real-world strategies, solutions, and resources that will showcase these changes and keep you ready for what's next. The Future of Workforce Learning and Development is heard live every Thursday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, 10 a.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Business Channel. Did you know that at the root of every business problem lies a communication issue? Communication Nation, a show that brings effective business communication practices to the masses, addresses a number of topics and talking points that impact your professional development, as well as business productivity and profitability. Host Jill Schiffelbein makes the theoretical tangible. Tune in each Tuesday at 8 a.m. Pacific Time, 11 a.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. Be ready to become a better communicator with Communication Nation.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio. Voice America Business Network.
You are listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or send an email to breakingbanksradio@gmail.com. Now, back to the program.
You're back with Brett King from Breaking Banks. I'm having trouble talking today. We have Rachel Schneider from the CFSI and Danny Shader from Payneer Me joining us today. So, Rachel, let me throw this one to you first. You know, what role has mobile had to play in sort of creating a new platform for delivery of basic day-to-day money management in this space?
Well, I think... It's had a role already, and it's poised to have a much greater role. So Danny alluded to this earlier, but certainly underserved consumers use smartphones and use mobile phones at very high rates, higher than the average population, and I think for exactly the reasons Danny described. And so there's just a massive potential to provide apps, alerts, information via the phone, let alone just transactional services, right? So mobile remote deposit capture is a game changer for a lot of people. And again, I want to point out how much more important that might be for an underserved consumer than for me, right? Or as a representative average transactor. So it's not such a big deal for me to go to the bank. I don't have that many things to deposit, and I don't really mind if it takes 5 days for a check to clear because I'm holding a cushion. If I don't have that cushion and I've got to deposit a check today, and I work at hours that mean getting to the bank is trouble, mobile RDC is a massive improvement over what I have access to today.
So in terms of this shift, what do you guys think in terms of the that aspect of that day-to-day money management and making those decisions? Can I afford this? Do you think that that's where the mobile is going to play, Danny? What, you know, in terms of your experience, you're talking about here a more trying to marry the consumer or merchant relationships, service relationships that a customer has, so it makes it easier for them to manage their day-to-day expenses and so forth. But do we really need something that helps people? Is it budgeting, or is it more about that awareness of how they're using their money? You know, what's going to stimulate these people to get out of this situation where month to month I'm just scraping by? You know, is the mobile going to be part of that solution? Danny, what are your thoughts?
I guess I could comment on what we're seeing in mobile use in our system, but I think in terms of what's going on behaviorally with the underserved, frankly, and what would get them out of the day-to-day, you know, the week-to-week living, I would defer to Rachel on that question.
Okay, so but talk about what you're seeing from a technology perspective in terms of mobile adoption.
Well, what we're seeing is mobile penetration of, so be very clear on how transactions work. Let's say you want to pay your rent. Today you might be going to the store, buying a money order, getting on the bus. You have a rental of a single-family property. So you're going to the store, you're buying a money order, you're getting on the bus, you're going to your property manager's office, you're giving them the money order. They are then having to take it, deposit it, and get it back to the bank. That's too expensive and time-consuming. And so in our process, instead to pay that rent, you're walking into the local store and presenting something at the register that they scan. Increasingly, that thing that's being scanned at the register is a mobile phone because it's an identifier, a means of communicating with the renter that's with them at all times. And in our business, the penetration of our transaction base that, by the way, is growing rapidly – a growing percentage of our growing base is mobile. In fact, it increases by about 2% per month. We're just under 50% of our transactions now being completed using a smartphone.
Wow.
At the register. And my hunch is, you know, it'll be 80% within 24 months. And frankly, it'll probably hover there because we also have cases where people print our barcodes on utility bills, and so, you know, people won't use a phone. But we see incredible adoption of mobile phones. And then what we expect to happen is, as people use their mobile phones to, say, for example, complete their rent payment, we'll then also be able to let them bundle all their other bill payments together into one transaction that they can complete at the same time. So, and that just wouldn't be possible if we didn't have mobile technology.
Yeah. So, Rachel, in terms of mobile adoption, you mentioned that it's higher in the segment. How are people? Do you know how they're using their mobile phone day to day in terms of financial stuff and banking related?
You know, I think the example Danny gave is fantastic. I think that the way you're seeing people use mobile is as a computer replacement. So it's, right, I've downloaded this thing, now I'm going to take the barcode to a Pay Near Me location. I also think that the more transactions we enable via the mobile phone, the more transactions people will make via their mobile phone. So right, we're still in the early stages there.
You know, I have something that may be relevant here. One of the places that we're doing a lot of work is with banks who want to use our retail network as deposit locations because they figured out how to do remote deposit capture for checks, but they can't do remote deposit capture for cash. And since there's sort of bank deserts in underserved areas, the ability to turn a retail store into a deposit location, both for consumer and commercial deposits, turns out to be extremely valuable. Take, for instance, the example of a person operating a nail shop in an underserved area who's got, say, $175 worth of cash in the till at the end of the day and wants to get that credit into their account. There's no bank around anywhere where they can make a deposit, but there might be a 7-Eleven. And literally, you can envision them walking in, making the deposit, scanning their phone, and instantly seeing on their phone that their commercial account has been credited for that deposit.
So, you know, this is, you know, we have this plethora. You know, we've got about 14,000 financial institutions in the United States, but that interconnectivity is sort of a challenge. So it's interesting to see some of these new networks forming on top of the mobile phone that allows that. Things like, you know, your service, Danny, the PayNearMe. You've got things like Dawala and Venmo and even PayPal. You know, I was talking to one of my team today, and she's saying she pays her rent with PayPal. So there are new structures emerging on top of the old system that sort of work around some of those old limitations where, it used to be you could only pay with a check or you could only do it a certain way. But these new methods of bill paying and utilizing the mobile are really becoming very interesting tools in this respect. Let's talk about sort of the regulatory environment a little bit more. You mentioned the Affordable Care Act, Danny. Where's the impact in terms of that playing in this segment of people?
Well, under the Affordable Care Act, if you think about it, all these insurers around the country are going to go from mostly getting paid by businesses to having to collect payments from consumers at scale. And in fact, if you think about it, they have to collect error-free transactions at scale economically. And that's not, you know, once you put the billing systems in place, that's a reasonable thing to do, pulling funds from an ACA, you know, pulling funds out of a bank account. It may or may not be economical to do it off of a card because of interchange. But you've still got that same, you know, huge underbanked population that's going to need to pay their healthcare premiums with cash. And I can tell you from the inbound calls we've received, you know, every insurer in the country is scrambling trying to figure out how they're going to do this at scale error-free. And in fact, there's proposed government regulation mandating that the insurers accept cash as a form of tender so that they don't exclude the underserved. Mm-hmm. So that's a huge impetus for, obviously, for our business. It's because I think we probably have the only mechanism that, in fact, could allow you to accept error-free transactions at scale in cash. And, you know, that's kind of interesting. We certainly didn't plan that when we built the network.
Sure.
But it's turning out that way. And by the way, it points to a really interesting, subtle thing about real-time transactions enabled in our network that people you just take for granted if you're banked. You know, it turns out that the ability of a merchant to not get paid is as important as the ability for a merchant to get paid.
What do you mean by that?
Well, so if let's say you owe on an insurance premium $120, you don't have the ability to pay with your credit card $80.
Right.
Because the process, the system just won't accept a payment for less than that.
Right.
But if I'm pushing money to an insurer through a walk-up bill payer that's wiring the funds where the recipient is not involved in authorizing the transaction, I can short pay that entity. And so there's a really interesting question that arises when a consumer, say, has a catastrophic issue or maybe a sub-catastrophic issue. They go to a healthcare provider, and it's unclear whether or not the healthcare provider will provide coverage because they don't know if the guy's covered. And the insurer doesn't know if he's supposed to provide the guy coverage or not because he wasn't paid in full.
Right.
So the ability, for example, by making it a real-time network like ours is, the insurer can say, no, if you owe me $120, you're going to pay me $120 or you're going to pay me nothing. That turns out to matter in many, many cases, but it really, really matters in this insurance case because you don't want to have ambiguity about whether or not the provider is in fact obligated to provide services to the consumer.
Hmm.
So I want to, in talking about this, because this is a very interesting area, the whole utility and how we pay for stuff and how we get paid for stuff. One of the other factors I'd like to throw into the discussion here is the use of checks, because, checks, all around the world, checks are in massive decline. Most of Europe is check-free now. And in fact, the US is one of these economies that's sort of been this holdout. Two-thirds of checks globally now are written in the United States, which sort of shows how far behind the US is in respect to getting away from the check. But there's been a shift recently. We know with Social Security, many of the government departments, the IRS, they're now moving away from issuing checks and putting this on a payroll card or a prepaid card. What do you guys think is going to happen in the check space? Is mobile the answer to that transition? Rachel, did you want to start off with that one?
Sure. I'm not sure I have a great answer. I mean, I think obviously what you're describing is accurate, and I don't think there's anything bad there for underserved. I think there's a lot of opportunity there for people who are currently underserved, because checks weren't inherently a great way of working, or these were folks who would have been maybe more likely to be banked in the first place. And so the government moving to more electronic payments has been a strong motivator to improve the quality of prepaid cards, improve the use of electronic payments. So I see this trend as mostly positive. I don't know how that will play into mobile. I mean, I assume it will mean more and more use of mobile services as well.
Okay, so listen, guys, let's just have a quick break. And we'll come back and we can sort of talk a little bit about what the future holds for the space. So we'll be back right after this break.
The business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio, Voice America Business Network.
In sales, are you a lion or a vulture? Lions don't wait, they just go for it. Vultures hang around until the lions are finished and just pick up the scraps. How can you set yourself apart as a lion? Join the other aspiring sales lions and listen to Forget Patience, Let's Sell Something with host Ty Maynard. You'll learn the tips and strategies of top sales professionals. You'll gain more clients at a faster rate and at higher margins. If you're a sales professional, business owner, or executive, listen in every Thursday at 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 Pacific on the Voice America Business Channel.
We spend 70% of our week in the office. What is the difference between enjoying your job and enduring it? The number one motivator is a positive work environment. And that's where Real Recognition Radio comes in. Join your hosts, Roy Saunderson and S. Max Brown, as they take a look at the positive factors of the workplace, such as employee rewards, recognition, incentives, and much more. Tune in to Real Recognition Radio, Tuesdays at 1 p.m. Eastern, 10 a.m. Pacific, on the Voice America Business Channel.
We're always talking business.
Talk to an expert.
Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
You are listening to Breaking Banks, featuring your host, Brett King. To reach the show today, please call 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. Or send an email to breakingbanksradio@gmail.com. Now, back to the program.
You're back with Breaking Banks. I'd like to give a quick shout out to our regular listeners of Jim Morales, who was on the show a couple of weeks. Jim has sent through a couple of good questions. A quick shout out to Chris Kovacs, who was asking whether we're affiliated with a certain TV show. By design, I would say, Chris, but talking about the future of this space, guys, in the last segment, I always like to get into what does the future hold? What's it going to look like in 10 years' time? What are we building right now today that's going to be a significant play? We've already talked about the mobile factor to some extent, but let me kick off. Danny, let me kick off with you this time. So if you're looking at 10 years in the future, in terms of these types of day-to-day interactions of payments, what is going to be some of the big changes? We see a lot of stuff happening in the P2P space right now. Real-time payments are big. Australia and the EU, the UK have all launched massive real-time payments initiatives in the last couple of years, and there's a big focus on that. So, What's it going to look like in 10 years' time in terms of the way we interact with money, with different merchants and organizations and this type of space?
Well, I think let me start by something I think that isn't going to change, which is I think the penetration of cash isn't going to be materially different than it is today, because the reasons that people use cash aren't going to change dramatically. But given that you're holding cash, if you're going to conduct a transaction, undoubtedly you're going to be initiating from a smartphone, and probably the thing you're interacting with, the POS that you're interacting with, is going to be something that's derived from smartphone technology. The transactions will be much more rich and sophisticated, much more laden with data. There'll be a lot more tracking of who you are, what you've done, what else you buy, what else can be cross-sold to you. I hope that the world moves to a more real-time payments infrastructure. I'm not like it's happening in other countries. I'm not sure that the powers that be will necessarily be in favor of that, because there's a lot of money being made in other kinds of networks today. Yep. But that would be my punchline. The other thing I don't know what the impact is, but I think that over a 10-year horizon, you've got to believe there's a return to inflation and a return to real interest rates, and therefore the willingness of people to hold funds, to pay people to hold their funds in prepaid instruments, is going to change, which then means that those products are going to have to bear interest. And if they bear interest, the regulatory environment's going to have to change. And so I just think there's a lot of complexity that's going to emerge regulatorily as a result of underlying changes in the macroeconomic environment that strike me as inevitable.
So, Rachel, you know, we were talking during the break about the data issue. How is data going to change visibility on your money? And what would you like to see on the data side that it would change people's lives in the next 10 years?
Well, I actually, hearing what Danny had to say just a moment ago helped me think this through further also, because I think that we haven't talked yet on today's show about the use of data. We've been focused on mobile, but we're obviously seeing an explosion of the amount of data that's available about all of us and that can be used. And I think that's going to make it materially cheaper to give people the products and services they actually want or need. And so, right, it's going to help us to manage fraud risk, which is always a cost. It's going to help us to market more effectively. And that maybe, as a real optimist, is going to be the counterpoint to Danny's scenario that costs are going to go up because you'll have to pay interest. And so I've thought that increased use of data is going to be a huge benefit in delivering services to underserved, and along with mobile, be one of the things that drives innovation, brings down costs, makes it much easier to give people the services they want and need.
I buy that entirely. Yeah.
Well, I think that if you think about just the payment instance, where I walk into a store, right now, pretty much everybody is focused on getting you to be enabling you to pay, right? Removing the friction on that. I think the other interesting parts of that is what happens before you pay and what happens after you pay. If you're looking in the 45% or two-thirds of, depending on the data you look at, of American households that live paycheck to paycheck or don't have a reserve, there's a very big question when you walk into a store, which is simply, can I afford to buy this? And there's been a lack of visibility on products to date, particularly core spending products, a basic checking account, which gives you no visibility on that question. Where do you think we're going in terms of being able to answer that question for consumers?
I feel like that could easily be the launching point for another hour conversation. See if his eyes vision, what I'd like to see is that, in fact, merchants of various sorts use that information in order to market to people in a very responsible way that takes the consumer's best interest into heart. So we've been thinking about this most strongly through some work we're doing around credit. And certainly I think lenders are going to have higher and higher levels of responsibility to only offer credit to people who can, in fact, afford to pay it back without hardship. And having more data makes that viable and enables, therefore, the borrower and lender to align their interests with each other. And that doesn't mean not offering profitable services. It means thinking longer term about profitability.
Danny, what are your thoughts?
One thing we're seeing already that I think could be real is the subsidy of transaction fees by merchants who want to drive by folks who want to drive other activity in the store. So if I'm willing to make my in-person cash payment at this retailer versus that retailer, then it might get subsidized either by that retailer or by, a packaged goods company that, would bundle the transaction and say, yeah, if you buy this brand of deodorant, we'll knock 50 cents off the cost of paying whatever it is you're going to do. And that's entirely that's a nice artifact. That's the good side of, data.
Absolutely. So we've got a few minutes left. One of the questions that came in, I know it's a little bit outside of the discussion, but helping this underserved or underbanked segment of the market. One of the questions is sort of helping them get credit and starting a business and things like this. And one of the things that was pointed to was crowdfunding. We see micro lending huge in less developed economies. Do you think there's a role for something like that, sort of micro lending, microfinance, crowdfunding elements here, Rachel, for providing credit to the underserved?
Absolutely. I think there's potential here. I'm going to sound like a broker record and say one of the keys to making that work is going to be data, because we worry in a regulated environment about how to make sure that both the borrower and the lender are protected in that exchange, and in the sense of having a reasonable certainty of being paid back, or in the sense of knowing that what you think you're getting when you the person you think you're lending to is in fact who you're lending to. So it is going to be important to those business models will have to live, as we talked about at the top of the hour, as prepaid does, in a regulated environment where the CFPB and other entities want to make sure that both parties to the exchange are protected. But there's huge potential there, and it's doable. Delivering those protections in a sustainable, profitable way means data.
Great. Danny, 30 seconds. Any final comments?
I can't top that.
All right. Well, look, thank you very much. We've had Rachel Schneider. She's from the Center for Financial Services Innovation, working very hard on research, reform, policy setting, and other areas for people in the underserved segments of the United States largely. Thank you, Rachel, for joining us, and Danny Shader from Pay Near Me. Thank you for joining us and talking about some of the innovations you're doing in the payment space.
Thank you.
Look forward to having you guys back on a future show at some date. You've been listening to Breaking Banks. We've been talking the unbanked and underbanked and some of the changes in terms of the financial services layer servicing these segments, and whether or not a mobile phone is going to be the future bank account for the world. That's Breaking Banks for this week. We look forward to you joining us next week.
You've been listening to Breaking Banks with host Brett King. Please be sure to join us again next Thursday at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Voice America Business Channel. We'll explore more changes and challenges next week.